Coming up on this week's show, news about the next MLS TV rights deal. FuboTV marks a huge development for soccer streaming services. FIFA planning major club tournament in USA. What the Univision Televisa merger means for soccer fans. First impressions of NWSL's 2021 coverage. Plus, we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. I'm Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, joined alongside my co-host Kartik Krishnayar. Kartik, we're going to jump right in. Did you catch any of the post-match UEFA Champions League, either on Tuesday or Wednesday?
No, I did not.
So you're missing a lot. I mean, for me, it's one of those things that I think for most people, I mean, to me, the sign of a good post-match show is as soon as the game's over, do you stick with it? You mean, in back in the day, back in the early days of NBC's coverage of the Premier League, I would hold on until the broadcast ended, even if it was like an hour after the game had finished, just to see what they would say and hear the interesting analysis and discussion. Tuesday, I thought was a little bit uneventful, but Wednesday, I thought was really good. I think they had some really good post-match. They had a debate. It was a little bit of a talk fest, like talking over each other. But they had a debate, and it was a great question. And Kate Abdo said, hey, if I'm Erling Haaland, which club should I join this summer? Should I go to Real Madrid, Barcelona, Manchester City, Liverpool, or Manchester United? And what they did was that each of the studio analysts took a team. So Peter Schmeichel gave the case for Manchester United. Micah Richards said, okay, Man City, here's why Haaland should consider a move to the Etihad. And then Jamie Carragher for Liverpool. And then he had Nico Cantor representing Real Madrid and Barcelona. Kartik, if you're Erling Haaland, what do? Do you stay with Dortmund, or do you go? And if you do go, where do you go?
I would look. His father's history may complicate this, obviously, with Roy Keane, but I would go to Manchester United. And if I'm not able to move to Manchester United, I stay another year at Dortmund.
Interesting. And that's actually, I mean, a good example. I mean, now opinions-wise, I mean, listeners, you guys might disagree with Kartik, you might agree with him. But to me, that's a good sign of good television. It's a good piece. It's a good 10, 15 minutes of thoughtful post-match analysis. I mean, you've talked about the game, you've shown the highlights, you know who's in the semifinals now, the UEFA Champions League. But what more can they talk about to hold the viewers' attention and to hear the different opinions about where Haaland should go or if he should stay? And for the most part, I mean, UEFA Champions League, I think this week was a good example of CBS Sports making improvements from what they did last week. And last week was great. We talked about the Jamie Carragher show. This week Jamie wasn't as center profile as much, which is good, which is fine. And Mark Klatenberg, they added on Tuesday and Wednesday post-match to get his thoughts. And from both of those games, both on Tuesday and Wednesday, there were, I mean, analysis. There was much needed. There were things that happened in those games where you needed an expert former referee. Actually, I think he's head of refereeing in Greece right now, the country. But you need that analysis to get an opinion, an actual really good opinion. So overall, from what I saw, I was impressed. And they're making improvements. They added Jens Lehmann as an analyst. Now the German teams are out of the Champions League. But still, Jens Lehmann spoke English very well, had some good analysis, some good insight. And things are looking up. I think to me, it's very positive. The moves that CBS are making.
Yeah, I don't think Jens Lehmann's expertise is limited to German clubs. He played for Arsenal, and it's English pundits who tend to focus on English clubs exclusively. I think if you get a German or Dutch pundit, they can talk about any strong continental team. That tends to be the case a lot of times with Italian and Spanish pundits, too. So I'm not into looking at the nationality and saying, oh, well, the German clubs are out, so he's not a useful pundit. That's an English thing, because we talked about with Carragher, and we talked about with other English pundits. They tend to obsess over the Premier League and look down upon other leagues.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And you got a little bit of that on Wednesday post-match where you didn't really have too much analysis or insight into Real Madrid. I mean, Real Madrid is looking like this is their trophy to win. I mean, they've definitely got a good strong chance and seemed pretty comfortable over the two legs against Liverpool. But because you have the studio analysts, I mean, Peter Schmeichel, Jamie Carragher, Micah Richards, who are former Premier League players, it is very Premier League centric, but maybe they think that maybe the Real Madrid analysis would be more so that viewership is going to be watching in Univision or Tuduene or Unomas for that type of analysis. So while the Champions League, to me, the coverage was good, we're going to bounce around a little bit here. I watched El Clasico last weekend, which I thought was a really good game, enjoyable. I had the weather conditions. I mean, huge amounts of rain on this pitch, and it was a good game up until like the last kick of the game. It could have easily been Barcelona getting that equalizer. A big match, big ramifications. But the one thing for me that I take away from this is it was probably the most underwhelming beIN Sports production of El Clasico. Not that there's anything wrong with, you know, Thomas Rongen and Eric Krakauer and some of the other analysts that they had on staff, but it wasn't, they weren't pulling out all the bells and whistles. This was very much a low-cost production without any of the, I mean, really without any pizzazz, really, on the English language side. The Spanish language side, I didn't watch the coverage of there to see how that differed. But this is really, I wouldn't say that beIN Sports is phoning it in, but they definitely don't have much of a budget, it seems, in producing, not just producing, but also the talent. They're not bringing in the big guns for these types of, the biggest game of the season for them. What, Kartik, what about you? Like NWSL this past weekend, what was your thoughts on the coverage that you saw?
Yeah, I was pleased with the coverage on CBS. I mean, I think unfortunately the Chicago-Houston match didn't end up being as open as, and entertaining as we had hoped. Part of the problem was that you had these international friendlies going on the same weekend, right? Sweden, USA, and France, USA. You had a lot of players. A lot of the top players in NWSL who weren't there for these opening round of matches, but then the Portland match after on Paramount Plus was quite good, and their coverage has continued to be good. I mean, there's an Orlando game tonight. The Orlando Racing Louisville match was phenomenal, right? And the atmosphere, and we have another match on CBS Sports Network tonight. We're recording this on Wednesday, so pleased with the NWSL output from CBS. The kind of coverage the league is getting, they're really committed to it, and they're also very aggressive about promoting it on Paramount Plus, which I like. So good first weekend. It was great to hear JP Del Camera call a match. Right, we don't hear JP. I realized this on Friday night, Chris. We don't hear JP as much as we used to. It seems like now more of an occasion when he calls a match. Mm-hmm. We were used to hearing him every week back in the day, whether it was ESPN, MLS, or was Fox after that, or whatever, or even international matches, right? We don't hear him as much anymore. So yeah. I actually maybe that makes the occasion feel bigger when he calls it, but it did feel like a big match, the opening match, the Houston-Chicago match on Friday night.
Yeah, whenever I hear JP Delacamera's voice, it's instant credibility. I mean, when I hear his voice, which isn't that often, but when I hear his voice, I lean in to the TV set. I want to submerge myself in that game more intently, more closely than if it was just a generic announcer that I had nothing to do with, basically, or kind of no attachment. I mean, with JP, there's history, he's come through the entire success of the U.S. women's national team, and of course World Cups and other things too. But to me, just a perfect voice for as an American commentator. Now, so we've talked about VAR, Well, actually, we haven't talked about VAR yet. Well, VAR, Kartik, I don't know if you saw this on this past weekend, but in the Premier League, I'm not sure what else we can say at this moment. I mean, there were just some horrible decisions. And I think it's gotten to the point, if it hadn't before, it has now, where it is killing the game. It is definitely turning off fans. It's getting people upset. It's not free-flowing. The decisions seem to be just ridiculous, some of these decisions. Part of it's not VAR's fault. Part of it is just the rules of the game have not kept up with VAR, and VAR is being used, especially in the Premier League, to micro-analyze calls, and sometimes it's the wrong decision, which is more infuriating. It's bad enough that there's long delays and there's all this, lack of passion. I mean, imagine if there were fans in the stadiums. So that's the thing we're missing, really, with this, with the VAR, is we haven't had massive stadium, full capacities of fans and these ridiculous VAR calls. Basically, we had VAR, in the last World Cup, and it went pretty well. There were some mistakes that happened, definitely, but there weren't any major VAR incidents where it was really controversial. With the Premier League, it seems to be almost every weekend. And sometimes, as this past weekend, we had the Man City Leeds game where there was the foul, I think it was on Raheem Sterling, and that decision, which watching it in slow motion, to me, it looked worse than what it was. I mean, to me, it's a defender going for the ball and his foot is raised, but he's going for the ball. And then, which was the correct decision based on the laws of the game, but I think VAR makes it look a lot worse. And then less than an hour later, I think it was the Liverpool-Aston Villa game, where there was a goal that should have been allowed. It was disallowed. I think Roberto Firmino scored it, and it just was called back. It took a while, and it still seemed like the wrong decision. But Kartik, is there any hope out there? Can the Bundesliga take their staff and move over to London?
Or any league?
Any league?
Look, there are a lot of people who only watch the Premier League, and they base their opinions of football as a whole on the Premier League. And I know the sun sets, rises and sets with the Premier League, and the teams in the Bundesliga and Serie A, they'd all get relegated in the Premier League, according to some of these people. But no other league has this problem. Okay, MLS. Well, we bash MLS a lot on this show. They've done a great job of implementing it. There are controversial decisions everywhere. I'm not happy with Champions League. I think Dortmund really got jobbed, if for lack of a better term, in both legs. Right, the Bellingham situation in the first leg wasn't reviewable, but that should have been a goal, and Ederson should have had a yellow card, and not Bellingham. And then obviously in the second leg, I do not. I guess I should reread the rule, but I think that was really harsh on Sean.
It's harsh, but I think it was. To me, it should have been a penalty with Emre Can on that one. But
You can argue it. But I guess at least they had a process to look at it, and they determined they didn't want to overturn it. They didn't have a process for the Bellingham challenge, which, by the way, I think the tie is completely different. The next 135 minutes or whatever, if that call isn't very badly blown, and I think there were a lot of calls that went against Dortmund over the two legs. I mean, they're already swimming upstream against a Manchester City team that's better than them, and not all these bad breaks.
But the Bellingham mistake was a mistake by the referee and was not a VAR problem.
No, it wasn't a VAR error. What I'm saying is, I would like to see maybe VAR expanded to include clear goal scoring opportunities, because we see this also with free kicks right outside the area where guys are pulled down and they can't review it. So that I'm actually looking for an expansion of VAR, because it's done well in other places. In the Premier League, it's not done well. The Premier League, as Stuart Robson said it a year and a half ago on ESPN FC, I thought maybe he was exaggerating, but he felt like part of it was the Premier League likes to draw attention to itself. They were deliberately not implementing VAR the way it had been implemented in leagues that went before them, right? There were kinks in Germany. There were kinks in Italy. There were kinks in the Netherlands. MLS actually had it implemented in USL first, so they started it at the lower division level, and Howard Webb worked it into MLS. They haven't had all these problems. And they don't have the constant, well, every week, these sorts of problems. So it's a Premier League issue. It's not a VAR issue. And I'm not a fan of VAR, actually. But I'm, if you're going to use it, I know we're not going to turn it back now. I think maybe it should be expanded, as I said, in the Dortmund-Man City example. But it's a Premier League issue. It's not a VAR issue. It's not a football issue. It's not an issue with the sport. It's an issue with one specific league.
So I disagree on whether you're on that, Kartik, because there are instances, and I've seen this too, watching Major League Soccer games last season, where VAR doesn't interrupt the game as much. So they're checking behind the scenes, letting the game flow, and there are incidents that happen where it's blatant fouls, and the game continues, but for whatever reason, you mean whether it's John Strong or whoever the commentator is saying, well, VARs were looking at that, but obviously they must not have seen an issue with that, so the game continues. There isn't that microscopic analysis. So the Premier League's issue, I think, is just basically how the process that they have in place, and also which is basically stop the game, analyze it, figure out what's wrong, which really kind of zeroes everybody in. Everyone's looking at it. TV viewers, you got managers on the sidelines with iPads, you got players looking at the big screen. I mean, everyone is upset by it. But then, so Serie A this past weekend, watching Atalanta against Fiorentina, the game on ABC, a joy to watch, great game. But the way that the rules are interpreted in that league is they let things go. So, yeah. And this is nothing to do with VAR, but there's a rough foul or a tough challenge, and the referee says, play on. I mean, I'm not calling that. And with the Premier League, it has gotten very, very... The referee's blowing his whistle all the times. VAR's looking at it. Everyone's getting upset at the decision, whether it's a good decision or not. And there are instances where VAR comes in and actually does rescue the referee and makes the right call. But I think it's just the interpretation of how and the implementation of how it's being used. And yes, definitely the Premier League makes mistakes. But I think a lot of it is some of those mistakes are happening in other leagues too. But those leagues are choosing not to stop the game and analyze it. The Bundesliga flows really smoothly too. I mean, I think it's only the Premier League that really is stop, start, stop, start.
So I get what you're saying, Chris, and you're right. In fact, I think there are probably a higher percentage of calls because of the way the Premier League's implemented it that are technically correct in the Premier League than in Major League Soccer or in the Bundesliga or in the Eredivisie. But what do you want? If you're complaining about constant stoppages, don't you think MLS has it right? Only in the most egregious circumstances do they stop the game and stop the flow and overturn a call. I mean, I sat in a seminar with Howard Webb, so I know his thing, and then got to do an interview with him afterwards. I know his thinking on this. He was very concerned about flow being interrupted. Now, Mike Riley had a different interpretation in England, which was get everything right or get as much right as you can get. So, you have to pick one or the other. Yeah. You can't have both.
Well, my thing is get rid of VAR, is keep goal line technology. And maybe use VAR for extremely, extremely, extremely wrong calls. I mean, somebody handles a ball on the line and it's blatant to VAR, but everyone else misses it. The referee misses it. I mean, the other officials miss it. The only way to actually see that blatant handball is by using VAR. And in cases like that, extreme cases, otherwise get rid of it completely. Because it does interrupt the flow of the game. It does become... just anal. It becomes really anal, especially with the Premier League games, when it is stop-start and looking at it and getting out the diagram to, I mean, the lines to figure out, okay, is this offside, going down to, I mean, the shoulder and the bottom of the shirt sleeve, and which makes you wonder if some of these clubs are going to start thinking about, like, maybe either reducing the length of the shirt sleeve or lengthening it a little bit just to give them an edge. I don't know. Yeah. To me, it was a really, really poor weekend for the Premier League in terms of just so frustrating for the neutral.
Yeah, I do think that the thing about the Premier League's lines also, and it's kind of funny because I think this year no club has had it worse than Liverpool. Last season, you would argue, in fact, there was a joke going around that, like, VAR the first season, I remember there was a GIF. Yeah, recall. Liverpool gets a recall, right?
Right.
So these things, like I say about officiating over the course of a 38-match season, these things even out. And I firmly believe that with VAR also. I guess in Liverpool's case, it's over 76 matches, 38 matches last season where they got the rubber of the green, 38 matches this season where they're seemingly getting screwed. So I'm not that bothered by it. I am bothered by the lines because the lines are very subjective. So unless you can pinpoint the exact moment the ball was played, and that's tough even with freeze frames.
Yep.
I think a tie should go to the runner. And that was always kind of the governing philosophy for center referees, officials, and for ARs before these directives came, which were related to the implementation of VAR. So you see ARs in the Premier League. And so now I'm going to praise the Premier League. ARs in the Premier League don't miss offside calls very much. They're usually very good. I'd say 98% of the time they're correct. Maybe 99. So I think in a lot of cases they're actually correct even now, and things are getting over. They're being directed not to put their flags up, let the play continue to flow, or they're calls are being overturned for some reason. The other thing I will point out is I don't like the directive about allowing play to continue because players are going to get injured because of that. Because if a play should stop and a player is offside, it should stop. So if the player is offside and the AR is instructed not to put their flag up, the keeper may come crashing out and someone might get hurt. It's going to happen sooner or later. There's going to be a serious injury because they're allowing play to continue when also players aren't moving at full speed because they're accustomed to a whistle blowing or a flag going up in that situation. So I'm actually very concerned about that aspect of it. I think there's going to be a serious injury to either an attacking player or a goalkeeper sooner or later because of this directive to just keep playing even though we know a player is offside.
All right, Kartik, so let's switch gears slightly before we move on to the next segment. And that is basically, this is a question that came up on Twitter. And actually, it was less of a question, more of a statement. But one of our listeners, I think JP Manning, I think it was saying that the Premier League season's over. It's done. It's done and dusted. The bottom two teams are, that's final. It's guaranteed. They're getting relegated. It's either Newcastle or Fulham that's going to be the third team. And I mean, top of the table. We already know who's won that pretty much. And Man United has it sealed. And maybe there's one or two other teams that are challenging for the Champions League. And the remainder, the vast majority of the Premier League, have nothing to play for. Agree or disagree?
Oh, I agree. I mean, there have been dead rubbers. I've said this for years with the Premier League, and not just the Premier League, every league in Europe. I criticize MLS also. I don't want people to now think I'm a big MLS fan and that I'm a shill for some or something, which people will say after listening to this. I know that's coming. But you guys always say that none of the MLS matches matter in the regular season because there is a postseason. I get that, but you still have to position yourself for the postseason, although oftentimes being at home in the postseason has been more of a curse. But still, technically, there are dead rubbers in MLS also, but not the whole season isn't a dead rubber. There are so many dead rubbers in England. I mean, for years, if you were West Brom, now they've become a yo-yo club again. But for several years, West Brom and Stoke, their matches after December didn't matter. Maybe it mattered for the other team, but it didn't really matter for them, which I think eventually caught West Brom because they started switching off at 40 points several successive seasons. And then finally they got in the relegation mire and they didn't know how to get out of it. And they went down a few seasons ago. But I think there are a large number of matches that don't matter. I do think this season is a little different with the top four race because you have Leicester has been sucked back in. So you have Leicester, West Ham, Chelsea, Liverpool, and Spurs, believe it or not, are still in spite of the results. Because a Mourinho team can go on a run. I mean, maybe we're giving him too much credit, but they could still win out. I could see them getting 21 points in their last seven matches. I haven't looked at their fixtures, but it can happen. It's happened with Mourinho teams before. So I would say there's that.
I totally disagree with you here. I think this is ridiculous. Dead rubbers? I mean, yes, there are some games towards the end of the season. We still have seven games to go. West Brom are on a winning spree. They've won two games in a row. They're looking good. I mean, if you watch them play, I mean, all season long, for the most part, they've played pretty well. It's not a bad team. Fulham's dropping points like crazy. Newcastle, Burnley, none of them are safe either. Brighton looks like they'll probably escape that zone, but still nothing guaranteed there. Then you've got Leeds United, which one of our listeners last week on the podcast was saying, like, Leeds has nothing to play for. Well, last weekend, I don't know if anyone watched the Leeds United-Man City game. Fantastic game. I mean, you tell me that Leeds has nothing to play for.
Well, no, these are like high-level friendlies then. Players,
yeah, they're not friendlies. Let me finish,
Chris, because I've worked in the sport, so I understand this a little better than a lot of people.
Well, me too.
Professionals always want to show their best, okay? So the idea that then this is what MLS critics say, oh, the players don't care because there's nothing to play for. No, if you're a professional footballer, you go out there and you play any opportunity you get. And in Leeds' case, especially when they have the manager they have, you know, if you make a mistake, you're out. So I think that these are professional guys. They're always in a shop window. They're always competitors. If you're a professional footballer who's gotten to a certain level, particularly the Premier League level, you are a competitor. Okay, and it doesn't matter if you know you're racing your little sister, your competitor. You want to win that because that's the drive that's gotten you to that point.
Right.
So I think these guys play hard because they're professionals. But I don't think there's a whole lot on the line in most of these matches. I mean, in some there are. Obviously, when West Ham plays, there's a lot on the line, or Chelsea or Liverpool, as we said. But for most of the teams, no. And in terms of Europa League spots, I don't think anyone cares about going to the Europa League.
Oh my God, Kartik! Come on. No way.
It's better not to make the Europa League because then you don't have all these extra fixtures.
I don't know. To me, like you take any fan of a Europa League club from the last few seasons, and you ask them what was that Europa League experience like. You mean, was it something that you were, you know, was it worthwhile watching those games? Did you enjoy that? Did your team, did you like the Thursday, Sunday kind of rotation, two games a week? And to me, I mean, there's a lot of fans that would probably say, yeah, Europa League sucks.
Are we talking about the fans or the players?
The players.
And the teams.
The players care.
No dead rubbers. There are no dead rubbers. Every match matters to a fan. I thought you were talking specifically about the clubs and the players.
I
will argue
everyone.
I'm dead red in the face with you on that. But if you're talking about the fans, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, but even the clubs and the players. These are people who are professionals. They're going into it like every game matters.
Is it the same in MLS then?
I don't think so. I mean, it is in a way. There is in a way. Okay, with Major League Soccer, definitely the players are playing to win. The players are playing to be professionals. The issue is with the fans and the viewers. Is for the fans and the viewers, what is their incentive to watch after the first two or three weeks of the opening of the season, where there is a lot of the kind of the enjoyment of watching these teams play, seeing how they perform. But then from, say, week three all the way through till July, what's the incentive to continue watching those games when usually most of those teams will qualify, or at least half of those teams sometimes will qualify for the playoffs? To me, it's more about the system and on the viewership side. Is it MLS is back, the tournament last year, to me was more compelling to watch that. The process of actually playing through that season, to me, I find that a lot more enjoyable than having just, endless, 27 teams playing this endless list of games. But we'll get to that in a little bit. But it's been a good discussion. And listeners, I'm sure you guys have feedback on this one. Let us know what you think, because this is definitely a hot topic. All right, Kartik, let's move on because we've got a lot to get to also. And let's move on to TV streaming news. And I'll have you start it off with some big news that broke last Thursday after the podcast went out.
Yeah, some huge news, Chris. Fubo TV has acquired the exclusive English language and Spanish language streaming rights to the CONMEBOL World Cup qualifiers in the build-up to the 2022 World Cup. Previously, the only way to watch these matches would have been via pay-per-view. I should start laughing. I'm sorry that I'm laughing to the listeners. I'm just thinking about how absurd the prices were in the last round of qualifying. So this is certainly good news for everybody. But this is huge news. And also, I think, Chris, another interesting thing, and I'm interested in your feelings on this also, Fubo continues to set a standard, right? They started off as a football, soccer streaming company. They've become this huge now kind of media streaming thing with Fox's money involved in it and entertainment options, et cetera. and a great option for cord cutters, but they still are so important in the football soccer space in terms of rights, in terms of coverage, in terms of what they're offering viewers of this sport. It's pretty amazing that they've evolved to what they've evolved, but they still have their roots firmly anchored in this sport.
Absolutely. It still is one of the most expensive streaming services, but it still has the most complete package of soccer choices. So it has all the Univision channels, it has the Fox Soccer Plus and all the Fox channels, NBC channels, ESPN channels. It has everything except for like kind of the ESPN Plus or the Paramount Plus, which is the standalone streaming services, which are completely separate. But for me, I mean, it's about $65 a month, but you do get a ton of coverage. And this is a huge deal because this is really the first time that they've done a major deal where they're going direct. They're going direct to CONMEBOL and saying, hey, we want the rights to the actual World Cup qualifiers, and we will be the exclusive home both in English language and Spanish language. So if you want to watch those games, the pay-per-view is still available. So if you wanted to do pay-per-view through DirecTV or through your local bar or restaurant, whatever it may be, you can still go that route. But as far as streaming goes, the only way to get this game is through Fubo. So that's going to attract a lot of people who may have had Fubo in the past or may have not even tried Fubo. But this is the place to go to watch those games. And that's a big development because up until this point, it would be, say, Telemundo acquiring the rights, which Fubo then streams those games, or it'd be Fox, or it'd be NBC, or beIN Sports, or whichever channel it would be, and then Fubo would broadcast it. But by going direct, they're actually now in competition with the Univisions and Telemundos and beIN Sports and Fox, and it makes it more of an attractive product as a streaming service. The funny thing about this, I think, is that, I mean, so Fubo is a public company, so they're on the stock market. The announcement was made last Thursday. We broke the news at the same time that I think that Fubo did and had all the details about this deal. And then on Friday, the stock jumped up, several percentage points, I believe. But it's interesting because a lot of the investors who are not soccer fans, who are not hardcore soccer fans, we're saying, like, just trying to really kind of basically throw mud or sticks at Fubo, saying this is a garbage deal. This is not really worth that much money. CONMEBOL must have been trying to give it away. Nobody wanted it. Just a lot of negative things about it. Probably trying to drive down the price of the Fubo stock price. But one argument was made, Kartik, and I want to get your take on this too, is one argument was made by a well-known investor, and he said that he thinks that the rights that Paramount Plus got for the CONCACAF World Cup qualifiers are more valuable as an investment than whatever Fubo paid for the CONMEBOL World Cup qualifiers. What do you think about that?
I mean, as a football fan, I would just laugh at it. But as someone who analyzes this, he's probably right. He or she's probably right because Mexico, if you get away matches for Mexico, Mexico is the national team that moves the needle in this country.
But I think the Paramount Plus deal doesn't include Mexican away games.
It doesn't include their home matches.
Oh, home matches. Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So they have all or their matches against one another. Okay, so that when we say it includes Mexico and U.S. away matches, it's not the Mexico match at the U.S. and U.S. match at Mexico aren't included. But all the Mexico matches, so they're what? This is the octagon, whatever, 18
octagonal.
So they'll have seven matches, six. So you get six Mexico matches with it, and you get six U.S. matches. But then there are eight you don't get. Whereas for Fubo, you get every Brazil match, you get every Argentina match, you get every Uruguay match. Colombia has a huge following in the United States. Maybe you're right. I still think maybe the CONCACAF deal is a little more valuable because of those. Those are still six Mexico matches. But, you get 16 or 18 of 18 Brazil, 18 Colombia, 18 Argentina, 18 Uruguay, 18 of everybody, actually. So maybe, yeah, maybe the CONMEBOL deal is more valuable. It's only because of Mexico we would say the CONCACAF deal is valuable. No one's terribly interested in there's just a niche audience for Honduras versus Canada, right?
Right.
Or El Salvador versus Panama. But the Mexico matches make it valuable.
And I think though too that the perception among the investors was that who cares about say Colombia against Uruguay? I mean, now as soccer fans, we go Colombia against Uruguay. That'd be a fantastic game. There'd be a lot of people interested in that. Neutrals would love it. But then in say the CONCACAF World Cup qualifiers, you could have I don't know Turks and Caicos against Bermuda or something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of. So I mean, the number of people that'd be interested in that from a soccer viewing perspective would be. I mean, much, much less. Yes, there'd be people that would be interested, but nothing compared to like Colombia against Uruguay, just as one example. And
I tell you what, though, living in South Florida, I think one of the things, if Jamaica ever got to a World Cup again, with the kind of accessibility you now have to qualifiers, that could help move the needle for CONCACAF in this country, because there's so many, at least in where I live, so many Jamaican Americans who they're more interested in cricket. I mean, they passively follow football and they hope Jamaica does well, but the federation's been very corrupt and they don't get into it the way maybe Mexican Americans do. But I think that's if Caribbean American nations became stronger, that package would be worth more in the U.S. But but maybe Brazil and Argentina don't move the needle that much either in qualifying, I guess, right? It's not like Mexico.
It's hard to say because a lot of those games previously would have been on pay-per-view or beIN Sports and beIN Sports en Español.
We don't have apples-to-apples comparisons.
Exactly. And this would be apples-to-apples. You got Paramount Plus. Again, well, actually, that's not even apples to apples. You got Paramount Plus against Fubo.
Copa America in 2016, when everybody was in the same tournament at the same time, Mexico, the ratings for Mexico games were off the charts compared to other teams, including Brazil and Argentina, right? Except when Mexico, although I don't think Mexico played Brazil or Argentina in that tournament, now that I think about it, but they lost to Chile
infamously. Right. Yeah.
Right, 8-1 or 9-1, something like that. But yeah, I do remember in that tournament, the Mexico ratings, we weren't doing this incarnation of the podcast yet at that time, Chris, but I remember you and I talking about it, being blown away by Argentina and Brazil moved the needle a little bit, moved the needle for a little bit for Fox, but even in English, when they were showing Mexico games, the numbers spiked up.
Yeah,
it was pretty shocking.
The other thing about this deal, though, too, Kartik, is it makes you wonder, okay, what's next for Fubo then? All right, so Fubo, I know, have hired a team of people that are involved, that are in their offices, that are focused exclusively on trying to acquire more rights directly. So this is something that's been going on for a while in terms of building this team. So they're going after other rights. But if Fubo can get the CONMEBOL World Cup qualifiers, which is a big deal, I mean, what's to stop them from putting in a serious bid for La Liga, you mean MLS, Premier League, or any of these other leagues that come up? I mean, they have a lot of funding available to them. Actually, Fox is one of the investors in Fubo, one of the original investors. That's a possibility. So I'm sure over at Major League Soccer headquarters in New York City that they're probably looking at this going, hey, I mean, maybe we should follow up on that discussion that we've had with Fubo and talk about maybe, I mean, how interested are they in perhaps acquiring some of the streaming rights to Major League Soccer. And I think at the end of the day for Fubo, if they get some direct deals, that's going to bring in more subscribers, but also it's going to retain the subscribers that they do have. I mean, the price point is pretty high. And if you already have watched a lot of soccer on Fubo, great. But you want to retain those customers. You don't want them to lose them to, I don't know, Sling TV or whoever. Now, moving on to the next news item, Kartik, and this is something that has not been confirmed, but it's a report from the Daily Mail, and one of the writers is saying that FIFA is planning on having the FIFA Club World Cup in North America in the summer of 2025, really as a dress rehearsal for the 2026 World Cup in North America. it's a dress rehearsal, but also it's going to be a cash cow because they are planning on having a competition that will feature, I think it's 24 teams, 8 of those teams from the UEFA Champions League, 3 of them from CONCACAF Champions League, 6 from Copa Libertadores, 3 from the AFC Asian Champions League, 3 from the African Champions League, and then 1 from Oceania. So you're going to have, you might have your Real Madrids, PSG, you might have, I don't know, Gremio, Palmeiras, and you might have Atlanta United, and you can go on and on and on, Monterrey, etc. This could be a very interesting tournament. I'm sure this thing would sell out, like crazy. And they could charge whatever ticket prices that they want to. They know that. So I'm sure they're looking at this as a massive revenue generator for FIFA. FIFA desperately needs to inject more funds into the FIFA banks. And I don't know, Kartik, I would be interested in this. This would obviously be another tournament in a very busy schedule. Would you be excited?
Yeah, I actually, when I play Football Manager, this is kind of silly, but when I play Football Manager deep into the future, I enjoy this tournament a lot.
Deep into the future? You play in the future? Like 2025 and stuff?
Yeah.
That's cool.
This tournament exists in 2025. Yeah. They have it already built into Football Manager. Yeah, I love it.
Okay.
I think it's going to be cool. I hope the TV viewers like it. Obviously, it'll be on Fox because they have the rights to the FIFA competitions at that time. And it's going to be really cool. It'll be even cooler that's in the U.S. Always in Football Manager, it's in Dubai or Doha or someplace. So, and I'm usually managing a European team that has to – I was managing Lille in the most recent iteration of me playing Football Manager, and I had to go to Doha from France, from Lille. So this will be a little different being in the U.S. Because the other thing about this tournament, though, the thing I've learned from Football Manager is it kind of short-circuits your summer, because what you do is you can't schedule as many preseason matches based on it because of it. At least in the game, they don't start the European season later because of this tournament. So basically, it serves kind of like a preseason also. So that's something to watch for European clubs. Will some view it that way, or will they all take it really seriously? I'm sure some will take it very seriously, but will they all take it really seriously? Because that's when it'll fall on the calendar.
All right, Kartik, it's been 5 months and 8 days since the last MLS regular season game. That was the final day of the season, of the regular season, when the Philadelphia Union won the Supporters' Shield. It seems like so long ago. But 5 months, over 5 months, and the league season is back this Friday starting, and some big matches on national television on Saturday and Sunday. Now, this week, Sports Business Journal had a story about Major League Soccer TV rights, the next deal. Now, the current deal that they have with Fox and ESPN and Univision ends at the end of 2022. Well, MLS is getting ready to accelerate that and get things moving in terms of the bidding and the discussions. And Sports Business Daily, Journal are reporting that MLS will start renegotiating its media rights deal in May and will go to ESPN, Fox, and Univision and talk to them about possibly renewing the deal. And they have until the end of the summer to make a decision what they're going to do. And then after that, there's an opportunity for Major League Soccer to go ahead and speak to some other broadcasters who might be interested. Those names could be CBS Sports, it could be Fubo, it could be DAZN, it could be, I don't know, HBO Max. I mean, there's so many possibilities of different streaming providers and TV networks, and maybe NBC, who knows, that might be interested in Major League Soccer rights. Now, the story that was written was behind a paywall, but a couple of the things that did come out of that story, and I'll read it word for word here. It says, MLS may find a tighter marketplace for TV rights than the last time it negotiated a deal in 2014, especially since the NFL took $11 billion annually out of the marketplace with its new deals. MLS will compete for rights fees with the Premier League, which sees its NBC deal end next year, adding to MLS's complications is the fact that one of the most valuable parts of its package, men's World Cup qualifying games, essentially will be gutted since the US team doesn't have to qualify for the 2026 event, which will be held in the US, Canada, and Mexico. Now, lastly, Don Garber also says the MLS fan base should help convince media companies to cut deals. We have a young fan base. They're digitally native. They're looking to access their programming and to find ways to interact with it, whether that's data, sports betting, as people go more over the top, and start looking for ways to absorb sports events beyond the traditional means. We couldn't be in a better time. An end quote there from Don Garber. So quite a few things said there, Kartik. What's your take on what Sports Business Journal said, and also what Don Garber said about the encouraging the soccer fans, the MLS fans, to go ahead and convince their media companies to cut deals?
On the Garber comments, I think that sounds a little desperate. I'm surprised. Maybe it just came out the wrong way. He's usually savvier than that. It sounds so desperate. In terms of the actual field, MLS, I think, is going to have to play the field to get the rights fee they want. Because if it comes back down to ESPN and Fox and Univision, and no one else is really interested in the rights, then I don't think they're going to get the kind of value out of it they want. So the hope is that Paramount Plus and maybe Bleacher Report, maybe even a Fubo or Fanatis or somebody like that wants, although Fanatis doesn't have the sort of money to be part of this, but you never know, right? So what they have to hope is one of those, or Amazon Prime, sees this as the opportunity to break in to the live soccer market in the U.S. Obviously, they're broadcasting football matches in England. We know that they have the Premier League midweek matches. They've been the matches around Christmas. Some of those midweeks, and they're showing cricket in India, right? And they're showing NFL football in the U.S. So what Amazon has done is that they've for their Prime product, they have latched onto the most popular sports in each country. Now, will they latch onto the most plentiful full sport in terms of rights in the U.S., which would be this sport? Otherwise, I don't think the rights fee is going to go up substantially, Chris. I'd be concerned, actually, if I'm MLS. And I think they probably are concerned. We don't know what the field's going to look like, and maybe they negotiate a shorter-term deal this time that just gets them through 2026 and then reassess at that point when you're on, or maybe through 2027, then you can renegotiate in the summer of 2026 or start negotiations when soccer is at a high point after the U.S. hosts a World Cup. That would be my strategy. So maybe a five-year deal this time.
So the part of this that makes it interesting, I think, is that it seems that MLS is trying to get the timing right. So the rights that they currently have with, I mean, Univision, Fox, and ESPN, they don't end until December of 2022. That's a long ways off. But by going ahead and starting the renegotiating process early in May, and then giving those three broadcasters, basically May, June, July, to come back with their proposals and their recommendations of what they want, and then possibly be ready to then in August either announce a deal or then go to market, go to have discussions with Amazon and Fubo and Fanatis and HBO Max and all these other providers, Paramount Plus, of course, and then maybe at that point try to get the timing right as far as trying to get a deal. Because it might be one of those things. I mean, the Premier League season, the final season of the current NBC deal, is next season, and that will end in May 2022. So around about the time that MLS has just started the last season of their contract, the Premier League will be wrapping up their season. So the Premier League, in many ways, it's very likely that they will announce their deal for the next 3 years, whether it's NBC or whoever it may be, probably about the August timeline, probably in the summer time. And that could be a good opportunity then. So if Paramount Plus misses out on trying to acquire those rights, or ESPN Plus misses out on trying to acquire those rights to the Premier League, maybe Paramount Plus says, okay, well, we missed out on the Premier League, but let's go in big and try to get the MLS deal. We need to go ahead and get the timing right. Let's get the deal done now. We need to secure those rights in order to make Paramount Plus an even bigger player than they are now. So that's my take on this whole thing, is I think MLS is looking strategically, and it makes sense to go ahead and get things started sooner rather than later, rather than waiting until, say, early next year to start up discussions then. And in Don Garber's quotes, he says, we couldn't be in a better time. Now, he's talking about a lot of these OTT streaming services. They're paying big amounts of money for acquisition rights to whether it's Serie A, the Bundesliga, etc. So that gets Don Garber excited, and he's thinking, okay, Major League Soccer could be a major player there, could be a perfect product, a league that could be showcased on Paramount Plus or Fubo or it's already on ESPN Plus, but on one of these streaming services. So the timing is right, and they're probably hoping that this soccer streaming wars of 2021, which is really a streaming wars of 2021, will heighten and get bigger, and have these streaming services putting down more money to acquire the rights, because it is a race to acquire the rights that are available. We know that sports rights have a lot of value to them, because most consumers will stop what they're doing, they'll change their weekend plans, they'll change their life around watching these games. So it's more vital than ever that MLS gets this right. Maybe they will, Kartik. Maybe they'll get a bigger deal out of this just because of the timing, not so much because of the value. One more thing I want to add to is in that story that Sports Business Journal did say that they were talking about one of the most valuable parts of the package being the men's World Cup qualifying games. I would argue that one of the most valuable parts of that deal is the women's World Cup qualifying games, not so much the men's, unless this team can really get better on the big stage.
The women's we see, and we haven't gone through the TV ratings for this week, but we saw a number for U.S. friendly, women's friendly, that you will never see for a men's friendly in this era, this past weekend on Fox. But also, the U.S. has qualified. I don't think the U.S. will have to have qualifiers for 2026. That stood out to me about the story. Also, when I saw that, I did a double take, because I think the U.S. would. We don't know the format yet, because there's three hosts and FIFA's never done this, but the assumption is the U.S. will qualify automatically. Does the U.S. end up doing what Qatar is doing now, which is playing in all these extraneous things? Like, isn't Qatar even playing in...
Yes, Antonio, they were going to play in Copa America, but then they bowed out just because of, COVID. Which actually, just to point that out, Kartik, actually, and that's my mistake, is the story does mention that one of the most valuable parts of the package will not be included, which is the men's World Cup qualifying games.
Because
there won't be any need for those games, because the U.S. will already automatically qualify. But my point is more so is that the rights to the women's games... are, even if the men had the World Cup qualifying games for the 2026 World Cup, I think the games featuring the women would be more valuable, because the viewership for those games is usually much better.
Yes and no. Okay, so this, I don't want to get too deep in this rabbit hole, because this goes back to the whole lawsuit and the way U.S. soccer played with the numbers. But the place where the men do generate more revenue than the women is in World Cup qualifying. But if you take World Cup qualifying out of it and you just look at friendlies that they play, the U.S. women have much higher viewership and much higher ticket revenue. So, sometimes the men's qualifying thing has been used as a justification by U.S. soccer to screw the women. So I don't want to get too deep into it. But, yeah, that reminds me that was the clever bookkeeping that the USSF did to make the men look like they were generating more revenue, was included all the qualifiers.
I'm optimistic that MLS can get a better deal than what they got last time, even if TV ratings have plateaued, just from the major factor of being the timing is right. The timing is actually really good. And especially if MLS can go ahead and get a deal done by the end of the year and say, hey, streaming company, Paramount Plus, as one example, you'll go ahead and start up in 2023. We're going to help you get everything ready. This is going to be a really great opportunity to lead in to the 2026 World Cup and have all these MLS games on television and streaming. And we're going to be talking up the U.S. national team and talking about MLS. This is going to be a really great package. And I think in many ways, if you didn't have that 2026 World Cup as the sweetener, this would be a completely different conversation. And if you didn't have the U.S. men's games featuring the U.S. men's team and the U.S. women's team, this would be a completely different conversation also. But so MLS, I think business-wise and strategically are actually doing some good stuff here to get everything, to get the most amount of money that they can at this time. One last thing, Kartik, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this one, but big news that came out this week is that Univision and Televisa, and Televisa is a massive TV network in Mexico. Univision, of course, based in the U.S., one of the most popular Spanish language networks, and they've agreed a merger deal to create a Spanish language content powerhouse. To me, as far as soccer goes, I mean, to me, Kartik, this screams out basically probably layoffs or pretty trying to take all the resources at both different companies, merge them together, and then consolidate and have layoffs and make it a tight ship. That's and it could have an impact on the soccer coverage, which I'm sure it will.
Happened. Yeah, right. I think you and I both know that that's already started with during the pandemic, because TUDN, by the way, TUDN, I remember it used to be Univision Deportes. Now yeah. It's the T is for Televisa. So they got rid of what they considered redundancies. I don't know why we consider them redundancies. I think they downscaled, in my opinion, and moved some of their operations that they had at Univision and just consolidated at Televisa in Mexico City. So that this will be more of that. The danger, and I think we've discussed this on a previous show, Chris, and I've ended up discussing it with a number of people the last few weeks. The danger of the media companies, particularly Televisa, and their control over Mexican football is more and more people, at least in my circles, are talking about this now. And as Televisa gets bigger and their footprint in the United States, where there are all these Liga MX fans are, and Mexican Americans grows, there's some concern about it. So for those who don't know, Televisa, and I think we did talk about this on a previous show, right? That it used to be that way in England too, with Sky owning portions of teams. But the Premier League is much cleaner now than it used to be that way. But that Televisa has a significant interest in a number of teams in Mexico, and they're not the only media company that does. So, but this is a fairly big deal in terms of, I think, Liga MX going forward, but we have to keep an eye on how it plays out.
TV ratings, and there were some really interesting numbers that came out from this past week. So you mentioned it before, Kartik, but the U.S. women's national team playing a friendly against Sweden. This game was on Big Fox. 713,000 viewers, which is amazing for a game that was at the same time or actually overlapped with El Clasico. I mean, this game didn't start until after, I think, 1:10 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday. El Clasico started at 3 o'clock, so there's a little bit of overlap there, too. But there's also the Crystal Palace against Chelsea game that was on NBC at the same time. It's a very impressive number, Kartik. I think this is something that, to me, is probably the most refreshingly great number. This is really, really surprising in a great way.
Dortmund-Stuttgart, although maybe I was the only one watching that match, but Dortmund-Stuttgart was on at the same time also. But yeah, great number, entertaining match, actually. Sweden played well, and unfortunately, every time the U.S. plays Sweden, there's so much history. And this is an ironic thing. Again, the women's game doesn't have the number of strong countries that the men's game does, but the U.S. and Sweden end up playing in every tournament, it seems like, right? Yeah. And in some tournaments, I want to even say there's a tournament where we played Sweden twice. I think we played them in the group stage and the knockout stage. Maybe that was even recently.
I think it was the recent Women's World Cup.
Yeah. We play them in every. We play them all the time. We played. We were in the group with them in 15. We were in the group with them. Or no, we lost to them in the knockout stages of the Olympics in 16. Yeah. So this is a bit of a rivalry. So maybe that generated it too, because I think even though France, England, Germany has kind of fallen off, but France and England are now maybe bigger deals in women's football. It's something about U.S.-Sweden. These games are always close. They're always kind of close-run things. This match was no exception. It's a very, very competitive match. Yeah, so maybe that helps stimulate it, in addition to the fact that the U.S. women are just very popular right now.
So some of the other numbers too. So Fiorentina against Atalanta, the first game ever in Serie A history to be on network television on ABC. 225,000 viewers on this one on Sunday. It was a really good game. I think in some ways this one got lost in the shuffle. There's just so many games on, and there wasn't a lot of promotion for this one. But it's not your Juventus against Inter Milan, but it was a really good game to watch, and I thought the actual broadcast was a great job.
So Chris, since that number came out, and I thought the highlight of the week for me on television was how well ESPN or ABC, ESPN on ABC, covered that match with Gab Marcotti at halftime and post-match. And
yep.
Matteo and Mark Donaldson did a great job. Dan Thomas is always an excellent job hosting. But when you compare head-to-head with the Bundesliga match they put on ABC, and again, that had Bayern, so maybe that explains the difference. The numbers aren't even close, which...
Right, less than half.
I mean, I wanted to see Serie A do better and just kind of incentivize CBS to put Serie A matches on big CBS. Maybe it was the wrong matchup. Maybe if you had Juventus, you'd get a similar number. But the Bundesliga number, remember, was close to 600,000. Mm-hmm. So,
yep.
Granted, that was on a Saturday. This was on a Sunday, but there seems to be a gap opening up between those two leagues, at least based on that number, which is disappointing for me personally, because I want to see Serie A do well.
Okay, Kartik, and listeners, I'm going to ask you a question. That question is how many viewers do you think the El Clasico got, featuring two of the biggest teams in the world, Real Madrid against Barcelona? In a match that meant so much for both teams, it always does, but even more so for those two teams, like trying to chase Atleti for the title. How many viewers do you think watched this game, two of the biggest teams in the world, on the Spanish language channel? What's your estimate? What's your guess?
I don't know, because Bienes.
The Spanish channel, though.
Yeah, I would say 400,000, because it's bien in Espanol, which a lot of people don't know they get. Or I would say 400,000.
That's a good guess, really good guess, because the number is 343,000. So historically speaking, we've looked at these numbers week after week, season after season. Usually the English language channel gets about a third of what the Spanish language channel gets. So probably on the English language side, which we don't have those numbers, but it was probably just over 100,000 people watched that game, which is pitiful.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah. So 100,000 plus 343,000, probably about 443,000 people watched this game, which is a decent number, given the lack of distribution that beIN Sports has. But again, this is possibly the biggest game in world football. So if you're La Liga, or you're the president of Real Madrid, or you're in charge of Barcelona's efforts to continue to market that team in the United States, you're calling up Javier Tebas at La Liga, the president, saying, what the hell's going on here? This is one of the biggest countries in the world that has one of the a massive population of over 300 million people. And we can only get roughly less than 500,000 people to watch this game, the biggest game of the season. So this has to change, Kartik. It can't go on like this. The numbers keep on getting worse season after season.
Yeah, and the same weekend that 800,000 people watch Crystal Palace in the same country. I mean, think about that. You just want to put it in perspective. More people watched Crystal Palace in the U.S. this past weekend than watched Real Madrid or Barcelona. I mean, that's madness. Yeah, I've been privately hammered by a lot of people for my kind of Johnny One Note on this. Ever since we changed to this format of the podcast, I've been saying La Liga has to get off of BN. I'm just going to rest my case here, because I think everybody now has come around to the same point of view that the league, it's unsustainable, especially with Serie A going to Paramount Plus. CBS will make a commitment to that league. We know what ESPN has done for the Bundesliga. We know what the Premier League's stature is in this country. I kind of just rest my case. These numbers that you're giving, that's it. I think it's over.
Listener mailbag. First up is Disco George. He says, or she says, oh wait, it's probably he. It's a George. Disco George says, lots of really interesting subjects on last week's pod. I'm surprised you all didn't mention Micah Richards's terrible gymnastics display from the CBS Champions League post-match show. Laugh out loud. With regards to NBC's Premier League coverage, the contrast between the NBCSN Peacock coverage and the Two Robbies podcast can be pretty stark. The Robbies, the Two Robbies have mentioned multiple times on the podcast that they really identify with the non-Big Six teams because of their own experiences as players, and they seem to really enjoy the underappreciated Player of the Week awards they give out as well. It would be really interesting to hear what they really think about the editorial direction NBC is taking. Speaking of podcasts, I think the multimedia aspect of soccer coverage is something that doesn't get talked about enough. I know that not everyone listens to podcasts, watches extra content on YouTube, or reads written content, but that was one aspect of ESPN's Serie A coverage that I really enjoyed. The Serie A Awesome podcast and the mobile app interface that puts written content, scores, and links to live ESPN Plus matches in one spot was a really nice complement to the match coverage. I'm sure the written content will continue with Gab Marcotti, etc., but I'm guessing the podcast will go away once their rights end. That is, I think, listener feedback of the week there, Kartik. Some really good points about the Serie A. It will be interesting to see what they decide to do if they start to pull back a little bit and not focus as much energy. And also what happens to the talent that they have that they're being used to promote the Serie A. Will they stick with ESPN or will they go elsewhere?
Yeah, so I think that the Serie A Awesome podcast, that's a really interesting question, because I do think that that's another thing that, to me, it's had a really good run and it's gotten better as we've gone on, and Nicky Bandini has joined. Kay Murray is on more now, or not the last several weeks. She just gave birth to a child, but. It's gotten better and better. I would hate for that podcast to be short-circuited because they've lost the rights. At the same time, I don't know what ESPN's incentive to keep it going would be. I mean, I guess maybe to showcase some of their talent. They do have the Gavin Jules podcast, which focuses heavily on Chelsea, it seems, more than anything.
Right.
Obviously, Marcotti and Jules, Jules Lorenz and Gab Marcotti. Gab has an expertise in Serie A and European football in general, and Jules has an expertise in French football and PSG in particular. But they both live in London, and they both cover. And Gab is a Chelsea fan. We know this, and Jules covers Chelsea a lot, covers Chelsea very closely. So it's ended up becoming a very Chelsea esque podcast. I love the podcast. I listen every week or watch every week, depending on whether I can watch or listen. They do not have the rights for the Premier League, but they've kept this podcast going. But maybe it's to showcase those two very, very high stature figures in ESPN's soccer lineup. And then you also have now the new show, Seb Salazar and Herc Gomez, Football America. Americas. Football Americas. Now, of course, they do show MLS, and they do have USL on ESPN Plus. They don't have NWSL rights. Seb, in particular, likes to talk women's football, and they don't have Liga MX rights. But so maybe Serie Awesome continues the Serie Awesome podcast, but I'm concerned it may not.
Next up is Carl. Carl says, I like the CBS Studios analysis, particularly from Alex Scott and Peter Schmeichel, when they're actually talking about the games, but I find my patience wearing thin for the incessant laughter, jokes, and ribbing each other. I'm a fan of the relaxed environment, but it seems like this has gone so over the top that discussing the games has taken a back seat to the bits. I also couldn't agree more with the criticism of NBC's Premier League coverage, and I'm pretty shocked that they still haven't had more integration with Sky Sports' Premier League content. It's very hard to think of lower hanging fruit for the Comcast Sky deal than this, and it's just puzzling they haven't figured it out beyond a couple of transfer deadline shows. RJ Hawkins says, with Fox's MLS deal expiring after the 2022 season, am I correct in saying that it's possible that Fox could broadcast the 2026 World Cup without the rights to MLS or even the 2026 games featuring the U.S. men's national team, any friendlies, etc.? Absent those rights, do you think they would present a more balanced coverage? Balanced coverage, no. I don't think they'll ever have any balanced coverage. It is possible that Fox could miss out on the next TV deal for MLS rights, as well as U.S. men's national team and U.S. women's national team. I just think it would be crazy if they did miss out on that, because everything that they're doing is building up for the 2026 World Cup. That's going to be the biggest one for Fox. And after that's done, they can cash out. They can say, hey, we're done with soccer. Thanks very much, MLS. It's been a great ride. Thanks, all you Euro snobs that picked on us for years and years. We're cashing out big time. We've made our money back from all these World Cups that we've done. And we're going back to NASCAR. We're going back to, I don't know, NFL, whatever it is, and focus on really kind of our forte. So it's possible. I just think it would be crazy for Fox to pull the plug on MLS and pull the plug on the rights to U.S. women and U.S. men's teams with so much on the line with World Cups coming up. Paul Kelly says, referring to the comment from Jazinho last week, I would also love to see a combined CONMEBOL CONCACAF league. However, travel costs and low attendance could be an issue. Don't see a sellout when Guatemala faces Argentina. European travel is much easier and closer. However, if they want to make this work, then I could see how an elimination round or two or three, the way that CONCACAF is doing it right now, would work. Naburo says, I would prefer the Copa America to have the 10 CONMEBOL teams plus the top six CONCACAF teams. Meanwhile, the CONCACAF Gold Cup should be held every 4 years. I hate the European Super League idea, especially having franchise teams like the Euro League in basketball. I would like the Champions League quarterfinalists to qualify to the next edition, plus the champions from the 24 top leagues. And I agree with Kartik that a luxury tax would help to increase parity without preventing oligarchs to bankroll their teams. Another issue is TV rights that often have unequal distribution. Kartik, a lot of people agreeing with you there. That's good to see.
Yeah.
And then Chris Guardino, last comment from our listener mailbag this week. Hi, guys. Another great pod this week. When it comes to Paramount Plus and CBS going forward, I think they should go after the MLS U.S. national team rights. They already have a part of the rights for the U.S. national teams in the form of the away qualifiers for the World Cup for the U.S., as well as the CONCACAF Nations League. This would especially benefit the U.S. women's national team because it would provide them with greater exposure and help to continue the growth of the NWSL, because CBS could do a lot of cross-promotion during U.S. women's national team matches to encourage people to watch the NWSL. The U.S. women's national team, in my view, needs a strong NWSL in order to sustain its long-term success after the current stars retire, and CBS is the perfect partner to help with this. The same could be said for the U.S. men's national team and MLS if they go to CBS, although to a lesser extent because the top stars for the U.S. men, Pulisic, Adams, etc., all play for European clubs So CBS would have to have to balance in how they do promotion during U.S. men's national team matches, because they don't want to be promoting the Champions League too much while giving MLS no promotion at all. However, having said this, CBS would be a major upgrade for MLS from Fox, in my view, in terms of professional presentation and having executives within CBS Sports that actually care about the league, unlike Fox, in my view, who simply view MLS as a way of getting the U.S. national teams on their channels. Lastly, I have a question about the use of non-soccer commentators. There are big names in other sports by some networks in the past to call matches as a way of drawing in casual fans. My question to either of you is, do you see CBS going this route with this year's Champions League final being on over-the-air CBS by using Jim Nantz instead of Peter Drury or Clive Tildesley? Kartik, a serious question demands a serious answer. And what is your answer to that question?
No, because I think we'll have to see what weekend, what golf tournament is the weekend that that the Champions League final is. But first off, if CBS has a golf tournament, Jim Nantz will be there. And secondly, if they have a golf tournament, it won't be on CBS over the air. So that's I haven't done my due diligence on that. I should have checked the calendar by now on that. So I don't think they'll go that route. I think that they're very committed.
Yeah. My answer to that is just is two words. Hell no. Whether he's available or not available, that would be jumping shark. I would be done. I'm out of here. Hell no to Jim Nantz doing the commentary for a Champions League final, even if it's on CBS over the air, which it will be. Hell no.
Yeah. There are some American commentators I think could do a job with it, but Jim Nantz is not one that's ever readily come to mind.
Gus Johnson,
who could call. But Gus Johnson is not a top level. That was the other thing about Fox using Gus Johnson on soccer that was interesting, because it wasn't like he's a top tier American sports commentator. He's not a guy that people would regularly think of as a top tier guy. Jim Nantz is, but I just don't think he's. I don't think that this is the kind of sport that he's cut out for. On the other issue, so let's keep in mind right now the most of the U.S. men's national team players are on Champions League clubs. So I mentioned Lille earlier in the pod. They're winning the French League right now. Timmy Weah plays for them. You mentioned Pulisic. You mentioned Adams. Weston McKennie will be on CBS both in Champions League, if Juventus finishes in the top four, but both on Champions League and Serie A. Yeah. And among others. There are other names. John Brooks is going to be in the Champions League next year. Wolfsburg is right there. In the top four right now. So I don't know if the U.S. men's national team coverage is as linked to showing MLS, except for these kind of B-rate friendlies, which they actually won't have on their network unless they get the MLS rights. In terms of what they show in CONCACAF qualifiers and Nations League, most of those guys are actually playing in the Champions League. That having been said, I do agree that the synergies between the women's and men's games, the women's game being promoted so well and the NWSL being really critical to sustaining interest in the U.S. women's national team long term, that sort of synergy might help MLS if it's on CBS. But I also think we've gotten past a point where there's a direct correlation between MLS fans and U.S. men's national team fans. In fact, I think so. There is a direct correlation between NWSL fans and U.S. women's national team fans. Chris, you and I have talked about this privately. I've talked about this privately with probably five dozen people. There is a clear divergence now that's really opened up in the last few years. You know, maybe really touched by U.S. missing the World Cup in 2017, but it was starting before that. A divergence between MLS fans and U.S. men's national team fans. So I think the synergies would be good from a coverage standpoint. I don't know if it creates the fan reaction that it will CBS having both U.S. women's national team matches and NWSL matches. I just don't think MLS and the U.S. men's national team are that correlated anymore in terms of their fan bases. Now, we know in a business sense they're joint at the hip through Soccer United marketing, and we know U.S. soccer and MLS are very close, but closer than most leagues are with their governing federation in the world. But I don't know that it's going to make a huge difference.
Yeah, good point there too, because I think in many ways the audience is fractured. I mean, it's not like it was maybe say 10 years ago, where if you were a fan of a MLS team in this country, I mean, you're definitely a U.S. men's national team fan too, and you support the country with as much pride as you do your local MLS team. These days, I'm not sure. I mean, I think a lot of people have checked out from supporting the U.S. men's national team, and a lot of them got frustrated by, I mean, depending on which team they support in MLS, they may have tuned out of MLS and tuned into U.S. the men's national team, or vice versa. It's not a a like for like. You mean if you get a MLS fan, he's automatically a U.S. men's national team fan in the same level of passion and excitement and support. There's not a direct correlation there, I don't think.
No, there isn't. I mean, there was at one time, and I think the divergence, Chris, may have started about 10 years ago. It wasn't noticeable until a few years ago. But as I've taught, as I said, I work in the industry. I've talked to dozens of people about this issue, that there is a clear kind of divergence. You can't see a television ratings or social media interactions for an MLS match and then automatically assume it's going to be the same people and the same viewers for a U.S. men's national team match. Whereas for NWSL, you can pretty much guess the 500,000 some people who were watching NWSL on CBS last year in the fall are part a subset of the 700, almost 800,000 people watching the U.S.-Sweden match on Fox. That it's much more correlated on the women's side than the men's side now.
Yeah, and we've seen some games, I think last year or maybe the year before, where it was U.S. men's national team friendly that was on Fox or FS1 that would be getting a viewership of less than 200,000 people, which is, I mean, you got some MLS games that have more viewers watching an MLS game than watching a U.S. men's national team game. So, that's a whole other topic for a whole other podcast. All right, Kartik, so any listeners, if you do have any feedback, questions, observations, want to learn more about streaming soccer or watching soccer on television, let us know. In many ways, we're kind of a customer hotline or customer service, customer support for a lot of soccer fans answering questions about watching games from around the world. And we want you to have your say. So you can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. Kartik, heading into another weekend, we've got the start of Major League Soccer starting Friday. We've got some big matches in the FA Cup. We've got the FA Cup semifinals. You've got a title race in Spain that's still alive. You've got a French title race too that's still to be decided there. Some relegation scraps. I think West Brom can do it, or at least make it maybe get down to the last week or two. Lots going on from around the world. So what should the listeners do, Kartik, and what are you going to do?
Enjoy your football.